Hi, I'm Gigi. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. And I accepted my gift of sobriety on September 14th of 1992, and I am not a mousy housewife. It was funny because that date that Jim brings up, when I met him at Dallas, in Dallas, and I wasn't, I was pretty sure I was at the Lambda meeting there, but I was new to town, and I wasn't, I didn't know, and he came up and asked me out to dinner, and I thought he was a straight man hitting on me, so we were both wrong about our presumptions. So I want to thank the committee for inviting me here, and I don't know, I don't see Sal. Is he here? Is he in here? She's getting ready. So good, because I want to talk about him. So I go up into the room, and let me get him here. I go up into the room, and he's got this really just a very beautiful card that he hand wrote out that was next to a gift basket with the coffee mugs, and there was some candy in there. It was just so nice. And so I open up the basket, and I look at the candy, and they're margarita sours, right? And I thought, you know, you can take the girl out of the alcoholic, but you can't take the alcoholic out of the girl, right? And so I thought that was so funny that those were in there. Because I'm sure they're tasty, but I never drank anything for the way it tasted. And definitely not alcohol-free anything, so unless it was free alcohol, right? I'm going to go, I always like to start off with reading a section, and then I close with a different section of the big book, but it starts off with, There's a Solution on page 29. It says, each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will see these pages, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. And I must have this thing. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love it with all my heart, and it's truly the most important thing in my life, right, you know, from the time I get up to when I go to bed at night. And it is, I always have to put it first and foremost, but to digress a little bit. I grew up, I was just telling a friend before the meeting that my parents were Glenn and Gwen. So they took their first initials and named me Gigi. And so that's my real name. And I have a brother, and his name is Hal. So he kind of missed the boat. He's an H. And he was from my mom's first marriage. And so I was the only child of my two parents. And both my parents had been previously married, which was kind of different that they had been divorced and remarried in the 60s like it was. But so my dad never made it out of grade school. He was a self-made man. He was a polygraph examiner. And so I grew up as a teenager with a lie detector machine in the house. And he, that's how he made his living, was catching people in lies. And so it was just a very ironic upbringing with that. I knew I was always different when I was growing up. I felt that when it came out to my family, or when my family outed me, actually, is how it happened, I knew that I had been different from whenever I can remember. I had always played with the boys and played army and played football and all that, and thought the girls were cute ever since I was little. And my mom would always tell me, when I first came out, she was like, I always knew, she said, I always knew you were different. I could tell when you entered school I knew you were gay. And then every time she would retell the story, I would get younger. And so she would say, I knew in kindergarten that you're a little different. By the time I was into my 30s, she was like, when not you were in utero, I knew that you were different. You know, so I learned some embellishment and storytelling from my parents, definitely. But when I was little, we grew up, I was born in Colorado. We lived in Amarillo for a very brief time, and then we left really fast. And then we moved back to Colorado and lived there, did most of my growing up in Utah, in West Jordan, and then spent from fourth grade through junior college in Scottsdale, Arizona. So I pretty much grew up in Arizona. When we were in Utah, we were the only Lutherans in our neighborhood. And my dad had a finished basement in our house, and that was my dad's bar that he had down there. My dad was a World War II veteran. And he drank like the sailor that he was. Now, my dad was a functional alcoholic. I don't ever remember seeing him drunk, but I also don't remember a day him going without drinking up until when he died. But he had this great bar downstairs that just had, you know, all these different colored bottles of alcohol, and he had this chrome or stainless steel Playboy mug with a Playboy bunny on it, and he had all these really cool swizzle sticks in it. And he had this travel bar that he took with him on business trips, and I remembered it was like this little shoebox that had black and white like alligator skin on it, and you'd open it up and it was blue crushed velvet on the inside, and he had a stainless steel flask, and he had a little tumbler, and I remember having my lunchbox and pretending that it was like my dad's drinking box that he had. And I was taking it to school because I was just mesmerized with all the paraphernalia that went with drinking, all the cool stuff, you know. And his friends would all come over, and my parents would have the other non-Mormons of the neighborhood over in the evening, and they'd all drink and go out dancing. And then my brother and I would go downstairs, and we wouldn't drink, but we would pour all the drinks in the glasses, and then we'd look at all the stuff because they'd buy each other all these little nasty gag gifts, you know, that they get at Spencer's and stuff. And so we'd look through all that, and then they would come home, and the next morning my dad would be very quiet, you know, very quiet and clearly hungover. But I didn't know what that was at that time. And one of the times that he had guests over, I was probably 5 or 6 maybe at the time, and I was sitting at the bar watching him clean up, and I saw the bottle of creme de menthe, and I asked him what that was, and he said, "Well, this is creme de menthe," and he takes it down, and I go, "Well, what is it?" And he goes, "Well, would you like to try it?" And I was like, "Well, yes, I would," right? So he just gave me a little taste of it in this little shot glass, and I know my mom would have probably divorced him on the spot had she known he was pouring a drink for his daughter, let alone in the morning, and I was like 6, right? And so I tried it, and I really liked it, and because it just tastes, I mean, it's creme de menthe, right? It's like NyQuil. It tastes like, you know, it's something minty, and it was like right away that obsession of the mind kicks in, because I wanted to taste it again. And then anytime he was downstairs, like, "Well, can I try that again? You know, one's not enough," and he wouldn't let me. Then, you know, he cut me off. "You're 7. I'm cutting you off, right?" And so Christmas would come around, and he'd like let me have a little bit at Christmas, and you know, and then he'd try, and he drank Old Crow and water, and that's all he ever drank, and he let me try that once, and God, I told my dad when I was an adult, I said, "Dad, that stuff was so bad, I didn't even steal it. It was the only liquor I didn't steal from the house." And he said, "That's why he drank it." So I tried that, and then that was that, and I never really dipped into their alcohol or anything like that, but I just always wanted that lifestyle. And I remember being little and playing cowboys and Indians and having like my little grape juice and pouring it in a little cup and pretending like I was shooting it, you know. And I was in second grade, and that's how I was playing. I wasn't playing with Barbies and other things. And I remember, you know, my mom just was always like, "You were always different." And so I remember this one particular Christmas where my parents weren't rich, but we were well off middle class, and I always got whatever. Our whole Christmas thing was we got the Sears catalog. I got to go through it and circle what I wanted and write the page number on, and, you know, Santa needed page numbers and item numbers to get those things in the catalog, and we would get that stuff, and I would get, you know, I got the G.I. Joe stuff and the control tower and the tank, and I wanted like the Red Ryder BB gun, you know, I wanted that for Christmas, and I got all those things. And one Christmas, there was one doll that was left off. It was a Chrissy doll. I don't know if you remember this, but she had this red hair that you'd pull out of her head, and then you'd dial, you'd wind up her stomach, and it would go back in. And my mom, there was one sitting off in the corner by the Christmas tree, and all the gifts had been opened, and my brother and I were playing with it, and my mom's like, "I think there's one more present over there." And I looked, and I go, "Oh, that's not mine." And she goes, "No, I really, there's a gift. I'm certain that it's for you." And I went over, and I looked at it, and I was just like, "My..." I go, I think Santa made a mistake, you know. I didn't want, and I asked her about that years later, and she said, "Yeah, I was just hoping. And, you know, so we made her like she was a G.I. Joe hostage or something, and we used her like that. And so I was fine with myself when I was when I was little, and I had a big brother, and I was football with him, and I was riding bikes, and I was doing all that. I was fine with that. I was fine, and probably until I got to about eighth grade, when all of a sudden all the girls that I hung out with got interested in nails and makeup and boys and all this stuff, and I knew I wasn't interested in that, but I so painfully wanted to belong that I would pretend to be interested in that, and it was just awful. And as I got closer to going to high school, I struggled so much. I did not want to be gay. I did not want to think about it. I was not happy about it, and I was gonna make it just go away. And so the summer before I went into high school, I started smoking pot, and then I started drinking. And I was 14, and so I started drinking and drugging on a regular basis at 14, and pretty much on a daily basis until I was 28 years old. And it was because I was not comfortable with who I was, and it was not, you know, my parents and my family never condemned it, but it was never talked about, you know, and so I just hated it. And so I hated it so much that I was on all the sports team and hung out with all the lesbians, and so that's all we did. And it was the same group of girls that were the softball team, that were the basketball team, that were the volleyball team, and I was on all those teams, but I wasn't gay, by God. And and so I got halfway through high school, and I was 17 years old, and I was going to gay bars. It was in Arizona, the drinking age was 19, so it would be really easy for a 17-year-old to pass for 19. And so we would go to the bars, and I would skip school, and I was getting in a lot of trouble. I was cutting a lot of class, doing a lot of drugs, and I decided that I got really tired of people telling me what to do, so I decided to join the Marine Corps. And it was another great idea. So I decided to join the Marines. Let me get my water. I decided to join the Marines, and so I started talking to a recruiter. And at this point, I had one DUI already. And he had told me not to worry about it and just not to tell anybody about it, that they wouldn't find out. And he said, they'll try to get you, you know, to confess to anything that you may have done and didn't tell them about. He said, don't do it, because they'll kick you out. He goes, you don't have to tell them. And I was like, okay, that was cool. So I got in trouble again in high school, and got suspended. And I was in my, I think it was like February before May graduation, I was a senior. And I had gotten caught with a keg of beer in my car at school. And so I got suspended. It was my birthday, you know, and it seemed reasonable, right? And that's one of the things that I've learned through Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I have a defect in my perception of reality, you know, and that was definitely my perceived reality of having a tapped keg of beer in your car in high school is definitely a red flag that there could be a drinking problem involved. And so I got suspended from school, and I was horrified. I knew I was going to be in trouble, and I didn't want to tell my parents, so I ran away. And that's how I would deal with things. When I would get in trouble or if something was uncomfortable, I would just run away for a few days. And it was an awful thing to do. It was a time when there were no cell phones, and my parents couldn't find me. And I'm sure they were horrified that something had happened to me. And I would always think that by the time I came home, they'd be so relieved that I was safe that we wouldn't have to talk about why I left in the first place. But that was never the case. And so I decided I was going to drop out of school. I had 2 months to go before high school graduation. I'm going to drop out of school because that's another one of those defects of my thinking. And I went to my recruiter and I told him, I said, well, you know, I can come in early because I'm quitting school. And he's like, well, you can't quit school, because if you want to be a Marine, a woman Marine, you have to have a high school diploma. He said, the male Marines, they don't have to have a diploma, but but the women do. Right, so you have to go back and get it, and that was my life is full of the best worst things that happened, and that was one of the first best worst things that happened, because I went back and got my high school diploma during the summer after my class graduated, and had I not done that, I know I wouldn't have the job and do what I do today. So I went back and got that high school diploma, and then I went into the Marine Corps, and I did not tell them that I had a DUI. And so we went through all the basic training and everything. And growing up with my dad being a polygraph examiner, I learned early on that it was the people that changed their stories when they were having the polygraph examination. Those were the people that got busted because they would become so nervous that they would just blow it, and they would tell the truth, and they would change their story. And I used to go with him to his office, and I would watch him do these polygraph exams on closed circuit television. I'd watch the people in the office with him, and he would get them to fess up to what they had done before he even turned the machine on, because they were nervous wrecks, right? Because they were already in trouble. And so I remember just thinking, just don't change your story, if you just stick to your story and take it to the grave, you'll be okay. So I knew I was going to take this to the grave when I was in the Marine Corps that I had this DUI. And so you go into boot camp, and the first person that comes out and talks to you is the highest enlisted person there. And she's like, if there's anything any of you have done that you haven't told us, then you need to tell us now. So I didn't say. And a couple weeks went by, and then the next in command comes up, and they're like, we're going to find out, so you might as well tell us now. And every time a few people would weaken, and they'd go and tell what had happened. And I'm like, I'm not going to tell. I'm not changing my story. There's nothing, right? And so I got all the way to the end, and there's like 2 weeks before graduation, and like the captain of the base, the woman comes in, and she's like, we do an FBI background check, and we'll be getting those back about a few days before graduation. And if there is anything that you have done that's against the law, we will find out, and you will be held here longer than you would be if you just finished your basic training and went on. Well, that did it, because I was like, oh, fuck, I got to tell her, right? So I went to my... I went to my drill instructor and told her that I had a DUI, and she's like, well, that's fine, and she goes, you can go take care of it with administration. She goes, there's a couple other Marines, women that need to go with you, too. And so one of them was this really little petite black woman that probably weighed 98 pounds, and then the other one was me, and then there was another girl that had been, like, the best Marine all through boot camp and was, like, the platoon leader and everything. I couldn't imagine what she had done. And so we all go walking down to this administrative building, and there's a male Marine, and he's filling out paperwork, and he asked the little black girl, he goes, well, what did you do? And she goes, well, I stabbed my boyfriend. I was arrested for assault with a deadly weapon. And I'm like, wow, And he didn't bat an eye. He just keeps writing. He didn't say anything. And then he goes, well, what did you do? And he asked me, and I said, well, I was arrested for a DUI. So he didn't, all right, he's filling that out. And he looks at the next girl and he goes, well, what is it? What are you here for? And she said, well, when I was filling out the documents and it asked if I have ever had a chemical or an alcohol abuse problem or a psychiatric problem, I checked no, and I've been through treatment and I'm sober now. And he paused and he looked at her and he said, you two are going to make fine Marines, but you're going to have to go home. And he sent her home. And we let us stay, the assault with a deadly weapon, the drunk, we're going to be the finest. We're going to be the finest. So, and I was like, wow, and I was like, see, she changed her story, and that's what happened. And that was my first experience with, being open about your disease, And so I went on and went through boot camp and went into the Marines and did it for a little while, and then it got in the way of my drinking. And I didn't want to do it anymore. And so I was a unit diary clerk, which I got to handle all the service record books of all the Marines. And everything that anybody does in the military impacts their pay, whether they have a dependent or a tour of duty overseas or if they've done this or that. So I would take and compile all that information and determine what they were going to get paid. And so it was really a great job for someone who's nosy, because I got to know everybody's dirt. And I got to see this is like your government file. This is your permanent record by the government. And it has everything in there that you've done wrong and everything that you've done right. And I got to process all that paperwork. Well, there are a lot of male Marines that would wanted out. They wanted out too. And so they would say they were gay and they wanted to get out. And that was like the first go-to punch to get out. And so they would get a dishonorable discharge. And I didn't want that to happen. And so I figured out, the reason they were getting a dishonorable discharge wasn't because per se that they were gay. It was because on your enlistment contract, you check a box that you've never participated in a homosexual experience. And if you checked no, and you really have, then that's fraudulent enlistment. And you're lying on a legal contract. And so you get a dishonorable discharge for fraudulent enlistment. And so I thought, there's a way around this, you know? And showing, and I just felt so much shame. And I'm sitting, and at that moment, I see there's this inchworm, this caterpillar that's going across the floor of the emergency room. And he's just inching across the floor, and I'm watching him, and all the people in the emergency room are walking by and walking through, and they're just glimming over him, and nobody's stepping on him, but they're just going around him and around him. And I knew any minute he was going to get squashed, right? And so I'm looking at him, and I just had this epiphany that was me, you know, that I was that caterpillar. I was doing whatever I wanted. I was going the direction I wanted to, all these things falling down around me, and it was just a matter of time before I was going to get squished. And, you know, as trite as that sounds, that was like the spiritual moment that I had. And I knew things had to change. And so that was Saturday. And I went to my first AA meeting on Monday. And Cindy and I had decided that we were going to get sober and quit drinking. And so we went to the meetings. I went to a gay AA club in Riverside, California. And she went with me. We went on our first night. And we came in. And, you know, sat in the back so that no one notices, right? However, she had this big white collar. She comes in, you know, so that nobody would notice. And she's like, hi, I'm Cindy, and I have a broken neck, you know. And so we're at this meeting, and I remember the guy that was sharing was a professor at my college. He was from UC Riverside. He was an English teacher there. And I'm thinking, I am so embarrassed that a professor from my college sees me here. Not thinking that maybe a professor from the university may have, you know, a little problem with one of his students being there, but oh no, like he's going to, the 1,000 undergrads that are there, he's going to recognize me and be embarrassed. But he was there, his name was Jeff, and we kept going back to that meeting, and that became my home group. And I got 13 months, and we had a big birthday cake, and we did a big celebration. And then I decided that I wasn't done drinking yet. And I my 13th month, I went out for a day. And it happened with the fact that I had had some foot surgery done 2 years prior to this. And because I was so nervous about the surgery, my doctor had prescribed me Valium. And so I had taken the Valium, had the surgery, didn't need the pills anymore, but, you know, you save them, right? You don't want to, you know, you paid good $5 copayment for that medication, and I'm going to keep it. And so I kept the medication in the house. And so Cindy and I had a fight, and I was embarrassed, and I was angry at her. And the thing that I should have done was what I was taught in the program would have been to call my sponsor and to go to a meeting. But I decided to take the kids to their friend's house, and Cindy was at work, and I was going to go lay out by the pool. And so as I was getting my things together to lay out by the pool, I thought, you know, I'm feeling kind of anxious right about now, and I do have a prescription for that. And I'm not abusing my medication because it's my prescription, it has my name on the bottle, and it's to be taken for anxiety. And I'm feeling some anxiety right about now. So I decided, and I wouldn't be drinking, right? And this is the exact thought pattern that I had. I am not drinking, so I can take that Valium. And I'm still sober. So I took the Valium. I went to grab my towel. I started to walk out the door. And here's the best part of the big book is this one sentence. It's on, and this sums up where all my problems ever started. And it's on page 255. And it's the middle paragraph, last sentence says, then I had an idea. And my idea was those Valium are pretty old. And I probably need more than one, right? So I went back in the house, I took a second one, and no sooner did I swallow that Valium than a voice in my head said, you've already fucked up, you might as well drink today. I mean, that fast. And so I did. So I went out to the pool. It was about 11:30, and there's always that group of cheerleaders that don't want to get sober that are waiting for you to come back and drink with them. And they were there. And so I came out, and they welcomed me with open arms and gave me beer, and it was about 11:30 in the afternoon, and Cindy got off work at 6, and I thought, I can drink till about 1 o'clock, and I'll take a shower, take a nap, go get her from work, no harm, no foul, right? So 1 o'clock comes around, I'm thinking, I can have one more, 2 o'clock, 2:15, I can still get in a shower and a nap. You know, it's 4:30, and I'm thinking, if I gargle and brush my teeth, I can pull it off, right? And so, because, you know, once, you know, I have this obsessive mind that once I feed it, once my allergy kicks in, then the obsession comes and I can't quit drinking until I pass out or, you know, or worse. And so I kept drinking right up to the minute when I left. I drove in her car to pick her up from work. And she walked out the door, and she came to the car, and I said, I drank today. And she said, no shit. And she looked right at me and could tell. And so, you know, she drove the car, and we were back going back to the apartment, and she said, so is this it now? Are we, like, drinking now? Is this what we're going to do? Is this our decision, you know? And I said, no. And I said, oh, you know, I start crying. I want to go to a meeting. I don't want to drink. And she goes, well, let's go right now. Let's go to a meeting right now. And I said, I really would like to take a nap first, you know. And she'd asked me, well, you've done other things than drank today, I can tell. And I said, yeah, I took one of those Valium. And she's like, well, where's the bottle? And I said, well, it's in the trash. And so long story short, I fessed up. At that time, I probably had 4 or 5 of the Valium and ended up drinking about 6 or 8 beer for the day. And so we went to a meet, and we went to a 10 o'clock candlelight meeting in Riverside, and it was awful. And I cried, and I was slinging snot, and I didn't look at anybody, and I didn't want anybody to see me. And that was September 13th of 1992, and so my sobriety date was that next. That was a Sunday, and I started work as a school teacher that Monday, which was my sobriety date. And I've been sober since then, and it's been a miracle. Cindy decided 4 years into our relationship, she decided that she wasn't going to be sober anymore. She felt that she had just been a codependent drinker and that she could drink in a healthy fashion. And I thought that was kind of funny because she was an alcoholic. But it wasn't my place to tell her that. And I knew at that time that I had to take care of myself. And we had purchased a home together. This was going to be another one of the best, worst things that ever happened. We had purchased a home together, and we had the dogs and the cats and the kids and all that kind of stuff. And she was a flight attendant, and I found out that she had been cheating on me with a pilot, which was a very painful thing, but it was the pain that I needed to sever that relationship and leave. And I remember being on the phone. Jim wasn't my sponsor yet, but I had a sponsor in California, and he was telling me, on the phone, he said, you're going to stay there till it gets more painful to stay than it does to go. And that's how my life has always been. You know, it change, when it becomes more painful not to change than it does to let go, I had to go. And it was the first time that I realized that it was easier to stay sober than it was to get sober. And I was going to have to stay sober. I didn't want to get sober ever again. And so I left. I had to leave that. I had to leave the house. I had to leave all my things. I had to leave a job. And everything. And that's what took me to Austin, Texas. And Austin is where I got to meet Rob. And it was a very soft place to land for me. It was a very kind and gentle and healing place for me to be. I had never had my own checking account before. I had never lived in an apartment by myself before, and this was in 96. I had never had my own pet before. I had never done anything on my own before. I'd always been enmeshed in an unhealthy relationship doing all these things. So I moved to Austin. Now at this point, I'm almost 5 years sober. And just because we get sober doesn't mean that we start to make good decisions. And I don't make good decisions. And so I meet, I'm in Austin, and I meet a woman who lives in Dallas. And she's cheating on somebody to spend time with me. And my sick thinking in my early recovery and in most of my drinking days, I felt that it was very flattering to have somebody lie to somebody else to spend time with me. I thought they must really like me a lot to have to lie to be around me. And so I dated this woman back and forth for a while, and she suggested that I move to Dallas. And I was really excited about that. So I moved to Dallas, and 3 days later she broke up with me. But it was the best, worst thing that happened, another thing. Because through that, I was forced to my knees to work my program harder than I had ever worked it before. And now I was alone in Dallas, knew nobody, and I had to go to Lambda. I had to go to the group there. Because that's all I know how to do. When things are so bad that I don't know what else to do, then I need to go to a meeting and I need to ask for help. And I need to reach out and I need to go out to dinner with people I don't know. and I need to have coffee with people that I wouldn't normally sit with, just because all I can do. So I thought, I told them, I wrote a letter to my commanding officer because I was too chicken shit to talk to anybody, right? So I wrote a letter and then I ran away, right? So I wrote a letter and I said that I was gay and I wanted out, and then I didn't show up for my duty. And so I remember I was laying out at the pool at my apartment, and I saw my commanding officer and like my staff sergeant pull up in their car and go up to my apartment. And I was just like sulking down in the lawn chair, and I was pulling my towel up. I didn't want to see them. And they knocked on the door and they left me a note or a letter to come in. And so I went into the base and I told them that that I was gay, but that I hadn't been gay until after boot camp. So that I was not a lesbian prior to the 18 years of entering the Marine Corps. It was those 3 months that I was there that changed me. So they didn't really know what to say, because they're like, all right, well, they sent me to a psychiatrist, okay? And so I had to go to this psychiatrist to prove that I was a lesbian, and I didn't know what that was going to entail. But I knew that it was on my birthday, and I was pissed that I had to go. And so I go to this psychiatrist, and I swear to God, he takes out that Rorschach inkblot test, you know? And he's showing me these association things. He's like, tell me the first thing that comes to your mind. He puts up the first one, and I said, vagina. Okay? He holds up the next one, I said, vagina. And I was like, vagina, vagina. Then he's like, all right. So he writes his notes, and I'm thinking that had to do it, right? So I have to be out. So sure enough, I got an honorable discharge. And I got out of the Marine Corps, and I was like, that was easy. That was easy. Got out of that. And so then, of course, you know, my drinking escalated, and my drug use got out of control. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I decided I was going to go I needed to go to college. And I started going to a junior college. And it just so happened that I fell onto the path of wanting to become a teacher. And I moved to my parents had moved to California. My mom was starting to get ill now and then, and they didn't know what was wrong with her. And she would go to doctors and specialists, and nobody could figure it out. And my father and I thought at times that, you know, maybe she was, you know, having, you know, maybe she had some mental illness, and she was imagining some of these symptoms because nobody could figure it out. So they moved to California. My drinking got really bad in Arizona, and I decided to do a geographic and move to California. And I told my parents I would live with them and I would go to school, and I wouldn't drink anymore. So my dad came out, and he picked me up, and we drove to California, into Yorba Linda from Phoenix. And I remember on the way in the car, he asked me if I had ever thought about Alcoholics Anonymous, and if I ever thought about going. And I said, no, Dad, they're like, you know, they're like this big religious group, and it's church-based, and I don't need that. I'm just going to take a break for a while, and it'll be good. It'll be all good. Well, I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, so I was making it up. And we get to California, and I start going to school, and my mom's, you know, my mom's health is waning, but it's nothing really serious yet. And I start working at this private school for communicatively handicapped kids, because I have some, I had some skill at that time of knowing some sign language, so I was working with some kids that had some communication needs. And one of the kids, I met a mother, one of the moms of one of the children there, showed an interest in me. So she had 3 kids, and then I started having this affair with this woman, and which it seemed like a good idea at the time, but, you know, she was married. And so her husband was really angry, and he would call my job. Now, the woman who ran this, well, Carl Karcher owned the school, and he's the guy in charge, you know, that owns Carl's Jr. And then the woman that ran it was this nun. And so her ex-husband would call and say that one of the teachers was sleeping with his wife, and it was awful. But and, of course, I'd be like, oh, he's just crazy. I don't know what he's talking about. And so it ends up she leaves him. I'm 20, maybe 22, 23 years old, and, you know, to get sober, I decided to take more physical exercise. I did the geographic, right? And so now I'm going to do taking more physical exercise. So I join a rugby team because that's a sober thing to do, right? Which it is not. And It is not. So I joined that, and I was still living at home, and then I was having an affair with this woman. My mom's health continued to just get worse, and they still didn't know what it was. And they thought she was having a heart attack. Took her to the hospital. This visiting doctor from New York stopped to talk to her, and she started telling him about her symptoms. And he asked her if she'd ever been tested for lupus. And she didn't even know what it was. It was in the 80s, and nobody really knew what lupus was. Well, my mom tested positive for lupus, and that had been what her health problems had all been about. The air quality in California was really bad for her respiratory system, so they went ahead, my dad and her moved back to Scottsdale, Arizona. And I stayed and finished school in California. And I still didn't really know a lot about lupus either, so I was just glad that we knew that there was a name to what she had been suffering through. So I stayed in California. Cindy left her husband and moved in with me. So I'm living like in this garage that's been converted into an apartment, and this woman with three kids shows up, and I'm an undergrad at UCR, and I'm like 22 years old. And so I said, well, all right. So we go through all that, and it's just all this drama and a custody battle and all this stuff. And her and I, of course, are drinking and drugging together. And we're together about 4 years. She wins custody of the kids, which was pretty monumental at that time. And we, the drinking is just getting worse and worse. And so we go on this camping trip with these other straight neighbors of ours who the kids all played together. And we're up at Big Bear Lake, and we're drinking. And it started off in the morning. I had got up first thing in the morning, and I started drinking early. And I was drinking vodka out of just a plastic cup. And she got up and she started drinking, and by the time the afternoon rolled around, we had started arguing, and she decided to go to drive home. And I told her that she couldn't drive the car with those kids, because we were up at Big Bear. I go, you can't drive home with the kids. They're not your kids, which was always go-to argument, right? They're not your kids. You can't tell me what to do. And she got very violent, and she started hitting me. And so I wanted, and we had had volatile encounters many times. We fought a lot. But not in front of other people. And so I wanted these neighbors to see what she was really like and that I wasn't the bad guy, right? So I wasn't hitting her back, and she was hitting me and punching me, and you know, it was awful. And the kids are crying and the neighbors are yelling stop, and you know, the dog's peeing, and it's just awful. It's just awful. And so she's throwing things in the car and I'm pulling things out of the car, and I walk away from the car, and you know, I had a moment. There are many times when I was drinking that everything would be fine and everything would be rational, and then it would just switch. And it would fade to black, and things would change, and I couldn't remember what happened. Well, I had that moment, and I clicked, and I ran at her while she was at the car, and I tackled her. I didn't hit her, but I tackled her to knock her away from the car, and she fell onto the ground. And when she fell, I kind of came to with things, and I looked at her, and I told her to get up, and she said she couldn't get up. And I said, get up, and she goes, I can't feel my legs. I can't get up. Well, when she had fallen, she broke a vertebrae in her neck. And so I'm standing there. Now, she's okay. And remember, she started it. That's very important. So, so the kids are crying. You've killed my mommy. I mean, it's terrible. Those poor, it was just awful. So the ambulance. So we're waiting for this ambulance to come up into the mountains, and this camping, the people that were camping across from us that we didn't know. This woman comes over and she's a nurse, and she's sitting with us, and she goes, "Have the two of you ever thought about going to Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I was like, "No." And that was a Saturday. Well, she was a member of Alcoholics. She was a member of the fellowship. So we go to, that was a Saturday night. I went to my first meeting Monday. But we went to the emergency room, and we're sitting there. And, you know, it was the 80s, and it was 2 days of camping and not bathing and drinking vodka out of plastic tumblers. I had a mullet. I had on a flannel shirt with the sleeves cut off, you know, and in all my glory, I was sitting in an emergency room in Big Bear Lake. And I'm sitting there, and they're trying to persuade her to press domestic abuse charges, and She's like, no, it's okay, really. And so I'm sitting in the emergency room, and I'm having that incomprehensible demoralization that the program tells us about, and I'm thinking that I almost paralyzed these kids' mother, and the kids saw me, and I want to be a teacher, and this is the behavior. That's all I could do was just cry. And I was not in love with that woman. I was in lonely, and I wanted somebody to be with me. And when I was in Dallas, I got to meet Randy, who's here, and I've got to meet more friends, and I got a sponsee when I was in Dallas, who was very important to me. And so I moved there, and really some good things really started to happen. And I was living in Dallas, so that was for about 3 or 4 years. My mom's health had deteriorated, but she was still doing okay. And then, you guys, this is, I'll have to steal one of my friend's lines, but I know you guys all have that website called Manhunt, right? So we have this friend of mine in Atlanta says that the lesbian site's called Finger Hut. So I was on this website making a pen pal, right? And I met this woman on that lived in Atlanta. And we corresponded a little bit here and there, and I finally got to the point, no pictures had been, well, a picture here and there, but, and then, no, really, it was a head shot, Randy. Okay. A head shot. Okay. So I finally got comfortable enough to tell her that I was an alcoholic. And she was like, well, that's really cool because I'm not really a bartender, okay? She's like, I'm a stripper. And I'm like, oh. And so then I went back to page 255. Then I had an idea. And it sounded reasonable to move there. And it was probably going to be a very healthy individual to have a relationship with. So I got to Atlanta. I lived with her for a year. And it didn't work out, right? And we broke up. Another worst best thing that happened. So it was, I had told my family I was moving to Atlanta and she was a performance artist. So, because I got to stick to my story, that's still in there, right? So so that didn't work out, but I ended up with the most fabulous job that I've ever had. So, and I'm starting to see this pattern, how God works in my life, and as long as I stay sober and I work the 12 steps, and I trust that the results, when I don't mess with them, are going to be far better than anything I can imagine. That every time something bad happened in my mind that it was bad, that it turned out, once I got through it, it turned out to be the best thing that could have happened, and I was happier than I had been before. So I get by myself. I'm living in my apartment. I'm teaching at school. And my mom gets very, very sick. And I had always told her, I was very close to my parents, and I had always told her that when she knew that the time had come that she needed to tell me and I would be there. And so she called me, or my dad called me, and she was in awful shape, and she got on the phone and she said, I think I'm dying and I need you to come home. And so I did. I went home. I got time off of work. That was on a Sunday, and she passed away the following Saturday. And I was with her that whole time, and I spent a lot of time traveling back and forth with my parents, and I love them dearly, and I got my sense of humor from them, and they both lived through, they went through their deaths with such dignity and grace, and never felt like a victim, and never blamed God, and I had this minister that I became very close with, who's also a Reiki master in Arizona, so it was very cool, and she became very close to my family, and she performed both the funerals of both my parents. She had told me that my parents and I were this spiritual group that always were always together, and whenever we reincarnated into a new universe that we would switch roles. And I thought that was such a beautiful story. And I'm sitting at my mom's bedside, and she's slipping in and out of consciousness, and I'm talking to her, and I'm like, Mom, Kathy said that we're always together, that the three, you, me, and Dad, we're always together, and sometimes you're the parent, and sometimes I'm the parent, and every time we go through the cycle of life, we'll come back and we'll switch roles. And she looked at me and she said, good, next time I get to be the lesbian. And it was awesome, That was like, it was like her last joke, you know? And it was beautiful to be there with her. And there's no doubt in my mind that there's something beyond this life, because I have experienced some of the most spiritual moments by being next to someone in their death, you know? And I wouldn't give that up for anything. I was with my mom when she died. And the energy in that room, it was the most intimate relationship or moment that I've ever spent with anybody. And then my dad passed away 16 months later after that. And I was with him at the last moment, you know, holding his hand and telling him that he was a good man and he was a good father. And I had no regrets when they passed. I had told them everything. I told them I loved them. They had told me they loved me. And we just sat and we just waited for it to happen. The best, worst thing that could happen. And it was the first time in my life that I actually prayed for them to be able to die. And it was so hard. And I felt, and I really struggled with the appropriateness of that prayer, but I realized that it was out of love, that I did not want them to suffer anymore. And I was able to sit with them and give them pain medication and around the clock and set the alarm clock. And I mean, it was, you know, liquid morphine and Oxycontin and all that stuff. And, you know, the thought occurred to me to take that, you know. I mean, I would have an excuse. I mean, my God, I'm with my dying parents. Who wouldn't do it, right? Well, someone who's not an alcoholic and a drug addict wouldn't do it, but but I did. I thought about it, you know. But for the first time, and it's only through Alcoholics Anonymous that I was able to have that selfishness leave me, that I did not want to take their medication because I knew they needed it. And I knew that I would be taking something from somebody who needed it. And so that was when they died, when they were both finally gone. My dad had died from lung cancer. I felt such a sense of loss, but I had also felt such a sense of relief that they didn't struggle anymore. And so that phase of my life ended. And then the sponsee that I was very close to in Dallas decided that she wasn't going to be in recovery anymore. And she was a very successful, she was a very successful chef. She had been on that Hell's Kitchen show. She was a local celebrity in Dallas, and everybody knew who she was, and she shot herself in the head. And she was gone, and that happened right after my parents died. And then I had a couple of students within a year commit suicide. And so it just seemed, I couldn't understand what was happening. But you know what? I didn't drink, and I didn't use, and I went to meetings, and I called people. Because that's what I do when I don't know what else to do. And, you know, the big book tells us that there's going to come a time when the only thing that stands between you and another drink is your relationship with your higher power. And that happened to me the first, my dad had died, and my mom died in 04, my dad died in 05, my dad died on Christmas Eve of 2005. It was Christmas 2006, and I was painfully lonely. Just painfully lonely. Again, I got involved with somebody who was not available, and they couldn't be available for me at that time, and it was my first holiday without my parents. And I remember sitting on the stairs leading from my garage up to my house, and I was in so much emotional pain, and I was crying, and I wanted to drink. And I hadn't felt like that in all of my recovery. And I knew that it was me and God, and he was the only one that was going to get me through it. So I prayed for help. I went to a meeting. I was pissed that I was at the meeting. I didn't want to be there. I probably didn't listen, but I went. And then I went to Dallas and went with my dear friend Jim, took me to a Cowboys game, and we enjoyed Christmas that way, and that was a blessing. And so so time goes by, and I start hitting roundups and having a good time, And I meet my partner that I have now at the Orlando Roundup 2 years ago. And it's an amazing relationship that I share with her. It's the first time that I've had a relationship with somebody who is in the program, because that was something that I wanted to be the only alcoholic. I didn't think that there was enough room in a relationship for two. And I had had a friend of mine, Roger, tell me one time that he said, honey, if you want a 90% chance of meeting somebody as sick as you, date in the rooms. He goes, if you want a 50-50 chance, date out there. So I always dated out there, right? And look where that got me, right? All those other things. So I met Amanda in Orlando, and I fell in love with her, and I fell in love with the program again. And during the whole time, you know, I've been sober, it'll be 18 years this month, I can say the one thing that I've never done is I've never taken a break from AA. I've never taken a break from going to meetings. I may have let a week, weeks go at the most, but I've never taken a hiatus. And I always do my first three steps every morning, and I pray at night. Now, mind you, there are days when I don't, and I feel it, and I know it when it happens, but there are more times that I do. And I'm afraid to do it any other different way because it's worked this long. But, you know, the core of my program is my relationship with God and the fact that I work with others, and I have to go to meetings. I just have to go. And, you know, if there are meetings that I don't like and there's groups that I don't like, but I have to get sober, and I have to stay sober. And I don't really have, I know that, because I've had my relapse, I know I don't have the luxury of being picky like that. So I would get to go everywhere and come here to San Antonio and be at this roundup is wonderful. And then I want to share one more story before I close. One of the things that when I was looking over the program to the San Antonio Roundup, I saw that that Rob was going to be here. And I was hoping that it was the Rob from the Austin that I knew. And because I remembered my favorite thing about that meeting, that house that we went to, is when we would, that meeting house that the Lambda group had there, is when we would say the prayer at the end of the meeting, Rob would say, "On earth as it is in Texas." And I love that. And I thought that was so cool that he did that. So with that, I would like to close with my favorite. This is my favorite passage from the big book that means the most to me. It says, "Some of our alcoholic readers may think they can do without spiritual help. Let us tell you the rest of the conversation our friend had with his doctor. The doctor said, 'You have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I have never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you.' Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. He said to the doctor, 'Is there no exception?' 'Yes,' replied the doctor, 'there is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences.' Upon hearing this, our friend was somewhat relieved, for he reflected that after all, he was a good church member. This hope, however, was destroyed by the doctors telling him that while his religious convictions were very good, in his case, they did not spell the necessary vital spiritual experience. Here was the terrible dilemma in which our friend found himself when he had the extraordinary experience, which, as we have already told you, made him a free man. We, in our turn, sought the same escape with all the desperation of drowning men. What seemed at first a flimsy reed has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. With that, thank you. God bless you and good night.